88.5 WMNF wants to hear from local artists like you. If you're a pull around Tampa Bay, go to our website at WMNF.org. From there, click on Ports of the Month under the Programming tab. If you're selected, your poem will be broadcasted on our airwaves. Be one of WMNF's first Ports of the Month by going to WMNF.org.
Well, hello, my health and nutrition fans, and welcome to another show with Dr. Fred Harvey here on WMNF Tampa. Today, his topic of discussion will be flu and cold season. Our phone guru, Clark, is handling the calls today and seeing that you get through to Dr. Fred. And you are invited to participate in this discussion, or if you have any medical questions, by calling 813-239-9663 or sending an email to dj@wmnf.org. You can also text us at 813-433-0885. Well, good morning, Dr. Fred, and welcome back. Today you want to talk about flu and cold season. That seems like a huge topic, so let's get started.
Well, thank you, Bill, and thanks for welcoming me back. I had a really amazing experience at that conference, and I got a little ahead of myself and told you to put up belonging as the topic for today, but I think when we're building community next week, that'll be a great topic. And indeed, it is cold and flu season again, but we've been in a cold season for about 18 months now. Coronavirus is one of the common colds. This really painful cold that we've been suffering with has been unusual because it triggered something different from most colds in that it really stirred up the vascular immune system and really caused a lot of problems there that colds don't normally do. You know, they colds stick in the head and give you a blockhead and lots of congestion, but they don't tend to go to the lungs like that, and they don't tend to go to the vascular system and cause different organ involvement. That's more like the flu. So we've gone into a whole new realm with this. But it's really interesting that last year we saw virtually no flu. And so that gives us some clues as to some things that we can do now that we're in the season. So many people in Asian countries have figured out one basic, really common and easy, non-invasive thing to do that took Americans quite a while to figure out, and still many haven't, and that's called masking. You know, colds are rarely fatal, but they can be quite disruptive to our lives because they tend to be very, very easily transmissible. Flu the same way for those aerosol particles. And because of that, we can easily stop some of the aerosol spread by wearing a mask. It will just reduce some of that transmission. Same thing goes for distancing and for quarantine. They work. And so if you have the sniffles, don't go to work. Use your sick time. Stay away so that we don't have to really transmit this to other people and disrupt their lives too. And if you must go out to get medicine or food, then mask up and distance. Don't stand right behind somebody that breathing down their neck because they don't want your cold. Wash your hands often. And if you touch your face, use some hand sanitizer so you don't take the flu virus and or the cold virus and spread it somewhere else. Foundational stuff is really important. I mean, I talk about, you know, the foundations of living. Blue zone type living. All these things are really important. So we know that eating well is really important. So if you want to really boost your vitamin levels, eat a rainbow of plants. You're going to get your vitamin C and your beta carotene and other things that are really helpful. You get your minerals. Many of your minerals come from plants. So you want to eat at least 5 to 7 servings of fruits and vegetables a day, preferably 5 vegetables and 2 fruits as a baseline. But even with that, it makes sense to add some more things in that give a boost. A daily multivitamin and multimineral has been shown to reduce hospitalization in people over 65. Vitamin C, I recommend during this beta coronavirus C season and the flu season, 1,000 to 2,000 milligrams of C extra a day. Vitamin D3 is really important. Recommendations range from 5,000 to 10,000. Some even recommend 15,000 units a day, but I stick around 5,000 for most of my clients and achieve really good vitamin D blood levels. Zinc. A baseline of zinc, I think, is really good. And 15 milligrams might be enough for the day. I see people starting to get some stomach symptoms when they take 50 milligrams or more. So I just try to limit it because you just need a baseline of zinc in there to assist all of your immune system to do its job. Reducing stress is really important. And we're coming into that part of the year where stress tends to ramp up because people feel like they have all kinds of expectations that they put on themselves and they feel that other people do too. But if we just relax and understand that expectations make stress, let's not have any. Let's just go with the flow. Do what we can to have a good holiday season. And make sure that in this season, we're in the South here, so going outside is a good thing. It's actually getting better to go outside. Up north, not quite as much, but going outdoors every day for a good 20-minute physical activity, just a walk is good, really helps to open up your lungs. In the South here, in the winter, we can get a little bit of vitamin D. Up north, you're too bundled up to do so, but it's really important to get that exercise. You also know that belonging to a tribe and having loved ones around is really helpful for the immune system. Social isolation, something we're going to talk about next week, is something that really decreases your immune system. So if in any way you can find that tribe to belong to, it's going to lift you up and make your life more sustainable. The thing, something you might want to know about colds and flu. Colds are, you know, rarely fatal. This beta coronavirus, COVID-19, we don't know, is very, very unusual. Influenza can be fatal, but not always from the viral infection. Autopsy studies show that about a third of people die from direct viral overwhelm of the system. That's only one third of the people die from actual influenza. About a third die from secondary bacterial infections. So the way people die from influenza-related pneumonia is a community pneumonia. The community pneumonia, like pneumococcus, is actually easily treatable, but does require antibiotics. It can be fatal. And about a third die from failure of one or more organs, like myocarditis or inflammation of the heart muscle. This is very similar to the mechanism of COVID-19, which is why I said that the inflammation makes it similar to the flu. So how do you know what you've got? A cold usually starts off as a little bit of funny scratchiness in the back of the throat, an intense nasal itching. If you feel those symptoms come on, make some nice hot tea or hot coffee, and you want to drink that and as hot as you can, because the heat actually denatures the virus particles. It actually warps them, kind of like when you cook an egg, the white, the clear part turns white. That's what we want to do to the virus particles that are sitting on your throat that they haven't quite yet implanted into your system. Make a neti pot or a nasal rinse with some warm water and salt, saline. You want to use the packets that are professionally made, or you make a mix of two parts of sea salt to one part of baking soda, mix that up in a container, and then use a half teaspoon of that into a cup of water. And you want to always use boiled water, that's chilled, or distilled water, because you don't want the bacteria in it going into your head. And wash away those viral particles. Licorice is really very good at neutralizing some virus, and so is andrographis. I use a supplement called Viragraphis that has both of these herbal extracts in it, and it's really wonderful when you take that when you get those symptoms, because symptoms will reduce quickly. N-acetylcysteine is an amino acid that helps to break up mucus, and it's really in high concentration in chicken soup. And so chicken soup, there's a study out there from a pulmonologist at UCLA that says chicken soup made this specific way, basically it's bone broth, decreases lung inflammation in the common cold, and it helps to break up mucus. It's very, very cool. And the thing is, though, the soup contains a lot of vegetables, sweet potato, celery, onion, garlic, carrot, parsley. And those have lots of phytochemicals that help. The flu is different, though. The flu hits you like a truck. You have aches all over. You feel like you can't get up and move around. You're so fatigued. You have high fever and usually a very heavy, dry cough. At the onset of fever, you know it's not the cold. You know it's the flu. So you want to try something to stop it. Oscilla coccinum, OSCILLOCOCCINUM, known by many in the homeopathic community as Aussie. Aussie is a homeopathic remedy that has been shown for 200 years to stop the flu if you get it early enough. Now, it doesn't cure it. It just stops the flu. So you still need to pay attention because if your symptoms don't go away, you need to be on top of it. Doing everything that I've recommended previously for coronavirus, vitamin C, D, zinc, quercetin, NAC, elderberry, virographis, licorice, all these things are very important. But there's also a medication or two out there. One that I've used in the past with very low adverse effects. So there are always adverse effects with any kind of medication. These just seem to be relatively low unless you're elderly. Tamiflu. Tamiflu does a really good job of ending flu in about 12 hours, but you have to get it within the first 36 hours. So don't put off taking any of these remedies thinking you're going to get better. The moment you have symptoms, take it so you can stop it. And the options are out there for influenza vaccines. If people want them, my recommendation is to look at the FluBlock, F-L-U-B-L-O-K, because it's a non-egg-derived and non-live virus flu shot. So there's different ones that can go in. Some are made on eggs. Many people have reactions to that, so I tend to avoid that. FluBlock is made on caterpillar cells. So most of us don't have sensitivity to caterpillar cells. Some of the other ones out there are made with live attenuated virus, meaning that they're a crippled virus that can't really infect you, but it causes the same kind of reaction to your immune system. Those are actually putting a viral infection in you, which I don't really like that idea, and I find good effect with the flu block. Now's the time to get it because flu season is on the way. And so if you want to get a vaccine, now would be the time to do it. So, yeah, if you have any kind of symptoms, get started early, do everything for prevention, and have a really safe and healthy holiday season using all the techniques that we've been trying to do for COVID-19 over all this time.
Well,
I have a question about a flu vax, actually. If an 11-year-old gets the flu vaccine, will that delay her ability to get the COVID vaccine when it is available? Actually, I see no contraindication for getting both of them, but I tend to not stack vaccines, and I disagree with the pediatric current way of stacking 10 of them at once. I think they should be spread out to give the immune system a chance to recover. And also, I just need to mention, for master citizens, those people over 65, they really need to consider getting a pneumonia vaccine. The Prevnar 23 is a very high quality, very good for seniors vaccine. And also FluBlock is very good for seniors, and they double the dose for it and not give a senior dose. So there are good options out there for prevention.
Well, it's pretty quiet here on the board, so let me remind everybody that you're listening to the Health and Nutrition Show on WMNF Tampa. And you can call on in and give Clark something to do by dialing 813-239-9663. Or continue sending your emails to dj@wmnf.org. And I guess we're going to be reading some emails there, Dr. Fred?
Looks like we have a few of them to go with. So this one's from Melinda, and she says, how would you treat a flare-up of diverticulitis? I was told to avoid fiber initially and then increase fiber as the flare-up subsides. Should I avoid nuts, seeds, corn? Do I recommend psyllium, Metamucil? And thank you for all I do. So, diverticulitis is an inflammation of usually the lower end of the colon. diverticuli are little pockets on the side of the colon that may or may not occur because people don't get enough fiber earlier in their life. And the flare-up would be initially rest. So yeah, you would want to decrease the fiber, especially the insoluble fiber, things like salad, raw vegetables, chewing up raw carrots. This is going to put an extra strain on the lower gut. Even taking things like psyllium seeds or flax seeds would be irritating at that point. So you want to calm it down. And my way of doing that is a detox diet where you eliminate dairy, gluten, all gluten grains, and most beans, and going on more of a paleo-style diet to let things calm down. And then begin to add things slowly back in as the flare-up subsides. Other things to consider during this are some fish oil that helps to calm down gut inflammation, a good probiotic that might assist in cleaning out some of the bad ones that are down there, and then drinking lots and lots of water to flush out the system. You really want to keep things moving. Bone broth could be helpful as well because it's good nutrition without adding a lot of stress to the gut. Seeds and nuts are a good thing to avoid because they have lectins and lots of fiber that would be irritating. But I don't believe that it's actually seeds that are the trigger for the diverticulitis. Corn could be if it's GMO corn, and some people just don't tolerate the corn anyway. Seeds don't get trapped in the diverticuli. The real issue is that strawberries have seeds, but strawberries are a huge irritant. I would avoid strawberries because they have histamine in, and that irritates the colon during this time. And peanuts have several different things. One of them is aflatoxins, and that could be irritating to the colon, especially if you have sensitivity. So I think that avoiding all those things permanently, probably not necessary, but definitely while you're upset, because there's things in there that would be irritating to that system.
All right. Well, we were able to tickle the phone lines a little bit and get Beverly from Lakeland on the line. She has a question about monoclonal antibodies. Hey there, Beverly.
Hello, Beverly.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I received the monoclonal antibody infusion in July. And at the time, The doctor told me I would have to wait 90 days before I could get the COVID vaccine. So about 2 weeks ago, which was day 70, I tested positive for the antibody. They said it was a strong positive. So my question is, should I wait exactly the 90 days? I can't seem to find any information as to where the 90 days come from. Or should I wait until my antibody tests negative?
That's really a broad look at it. I'm really glad you asked this question. So I wanted to talk about monoclonal antibodies again. They work. They're highly effective. But there's something we don't take into account. The body has to clean up after that. Because when you put this protein in, monoclonal antibodies are a protein. It's a foreign protein. It's going to bind up the viral particles in your body. That antigen-antibody complex is junk that your spleen and your liver have to filter out and clear. I think that taking proteolytic enzymes, things like Wobenzyme or Proteozyme, a couple of those on an empty stomach 3 times a day helps to clean out some of that debris that's left around. And then I would do that for at least a month afterwards. You're a bit late for that now. You can still do it. It might help clean up the system a bit more. But with the advent of positive COVID antibodies and a strong response, you have actually developed natural immunity. And it is the belief of most of the natural community that these are actually very effective at preventing illness. And so at 90 days from the shot of monoclonal, you could consider getting that, but you do have immunity now, according to the fact that you have positive COVID antibodies, which gives you a broader range of antibody protection than the shot, because the shot gives you protection only from COVID spike protein, whereas you actually have protection for the whole COVID particle. And you might actually look, Sean just sent me an email that on WMNF website, we have a link for the Regeneron monoclonal antibody treatment sites as well. So Many people are recommending that you get a follow-up shot. I think that's your choice because you actually have natural immunity. If you continue to take the COVID prevention protocol that I've talked about numerous times, you're in really good shape, I believe. But I would never deter you from getting an injection should you so choose.
So the COVID vaccine should enhance my natural immunity and not deter it?
It doesn't enhance your natural immunity, but it actually adds specific immunity for the Wuhan variety of the coronavirus, the one that was here last year. It doesn't give you anything against Delta, which is here now. Well, it gives you a little bit, but it's not the same thing. You probably got Delta this July, so you probably already have that. And if you get the current shot, you're going to have some immunity for the Wuhan, which was the one here last year.
Well, that's very helpful. Hopefully that'll get me prepared for the next variant.
Could be. There's going to be more, probably.
Well, thank you again.
You're very welcome, Beverly. Have a great day. And stay safe.
Thank you. Bye now.
Good advice there. And we're cold in here, so you're going to have to go and help some people on the email side.
Very good. Very good. This is what's been Joan. Thanks for this show. I have heard Dr. Harvey talk about 3 milligrams melatonin for sleep. Would like to try. When in evening is best? Also take CBD oil at night. Well, I take the melatonin just before I go to bed. I have a 5 milligram continuous release tablet. I bite it in half, chew up the first part so it can act immediately, and then the rest is for the rest of the night. I take that also with some CBD oil and some magnesium and some gamma-aminobutyric acid, GABA. It's the normal neurotransmitter that gets you to sleep at night. And I find that's really effective for me. Here's another one. How do you treat plant thorn arthritis? Well, my guess is that you got a plant thorn stuck in your joint. I don't know of any other thing that would be plant thorn arthritis. And so that would mean, one, you have to remove the foreign body. Two, if the foreign body went through your skin, it's likely it put some bacteria into your joint. And bacteria in the joint is not a good thing. That could end up in complete joint destruction. So if you have a swollen joint from having a plant thorn stick it, you need to see a doctor and get that evaluated for what's called a septic arthritis. That's not a good thing. So get help as soon as possible.
It looks like we're getting a caller coming on in, so I'll buy a little bit of time by reminding everybody that you're listening to Health and Nutrition on WMNF Tampa, and you can include yourself in the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or sending your email to dj@wmnf.org. And yes, there's Lynn for us. Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning. I have a question about fermented beta-glucans. Back in February, I was undergoing radiation for 5.5 weeks after breast cancer surgery, and I had heard you talk about this is enhancing the radiation to make sure there weren't any leftover cancer cells. But when I asked my oncologist about it, he said, absolutely not. I should not be taking any supplements, anything to boost my immunity because it made the radiation less effective. And I had also been told that about antibiotics. When I took a course of antibiotics and it wasn't really effective, the doctor asked me if I'd been taking my vitamins, and I said yes. He said, well, you need to not take anything that would increase your immunity when you're doing antibiotics. So I just wanted your opinion about that.
That's really fascinating. I am rather distressed that my former colleagues are so uneducated. But beta-glucan I've never known beta-glucan to specifically enhance radiation. What beta-glucan does is it stimulates your natural killer cells.
Uh-huh.
Those are your white blood cells that actually kill cancer cells. So those natural killer cells are actually diminished by radiation. So if you can do anything to increase their activity, it's a benefit. Unfortunately, many doctors have absolutely no idea what nutritional supplements are. They refuse to actually educate themselves, and so they talk trash about stuff they don't understand, which is kind of human nature to diss things like that. Ego gets involved. And so even though they don't know anything, they're telling you that they do and telling you to do the wrong thing. Beta-glucan should always be taken by somebody with cancer that wants to try and eliminate it, and it doesn't interfere with radiation therapy. And there are actually no good reasons to not boost your immune system while you're taking antibiotics, because you're taking them because your immune system has been overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there may be a small argument against antioxidants on the day of your radiation, because radiation is trying to cause oxidative stress. That's how it works.
Uh-huh.
It kills through oxidation. So the thing is, though, once the radiation has done its damage, it's going to keep cascading through your tissues, doing more damage into normal tissues, too. So taking vitamin C or other antioxidants on days you're not actually doing the radiation, or not at the time you're doing the radiation, I have yet to see a single study that shows that there is actually interference. It's completely hypothesis. And so, I've not seen any evidence. In fact, there used to be until another administration came in and kind of trashed a lot of the NIH's websites. There was some stuff on there about using high-dose vitamin C during cancer therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, on the National Institutes of Health website.
So I'm very conscientious about the vitamin C intake, but I base it on food, and I'm sure throughout the day to get sources, different vegetables and fruit sources of vitamin C, because I know my body can't store it. But the radiation was daily, and of course on the weekends I could have supplemented with my vitamins, but I chose to believe the oncologist because, you know, when you've just been through cancer surgery, you want to be sure that you're doing everything you can to follow their protocol, because I don't have a medical degree, and so I was at his mercy to understand and know. But I am back taking the fermented beta-glucans with all the other vitamins I take, and I know I feel better when I take them. So, I follow my instincts after treatment. And I guess time will tell whether I did the right thing or not.
You did what was right for you at the time. It's all good. And one thing to empower you and other people who dealing with specialists who don't have a specialty in nutrition, that you ask them, do you have evidence for your statement? Can you show me where there's evidence that beta-glucan will interfere with your planned therapy? Because I will make that decision based on your evidence, but not on your opinion that seems to be quite uninformed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I
appreciate you clarifying that, and I am certainly one that would say my piece and not cower. But like I said, it just seemed to be a conflict in knowing what was best.
I see so many people being put between a rock and a hard place by oncologists who are absolutely obstinate and ignorant because they don't actually know the truth, and they will tell you stuff.
Mm-hmm. I actually had a doctor do a biopsy, and she told me that she had zero training in nutrition. And I said, Well, it doesn't surprise me, but at least she admitted that she doesn't know what might help me in the way of, vitamins and nutrients and minerals. So, no, I realize we have to take responsibility for our own health, and that's the way I try to live my life.
I think that's the best key. You really have to be your own advocate, and if you are at all firm, or you, even if you're not, I would say if you go to a specialist, take an advocate. So you have two sets of ears listening and two sets of questions to ask, because I think it's really important you get all the information when you go into those situations, because you want to know what are the likelihoods of this happening, what are the likelihoods of that happening, what's the likelihood of having success here. Give me a few percentages so I can make a logical decision. Don't just tell me everything's fine, I've never seen a complication, you need this or you'll die. That kind of reasoning doesn't work for me.
Well, your show is very helpful. I'm listening every Monday, and I appreciate the information that you have researched and shown. You know what works for you, and that's very important. I'm grateful that we have you in the community.
I appreciate that so much. And next week, call in, or even during this week, please, we're having the fund drive. Give us a call and donate to the show to keep this on the air.
Okay, I will. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much yourself.
Bye.
Have a great day.
Yes, and that is a good point there, Dr. Fred, about donating to the show, and they can do that at going to the tip jar at WMNF.org. And I've got Dave here from Clearwater with a question about or concern about bruises on his arm from blood thinners.
Good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
I'm 66 years old, and a few months ago I started getting bruising that was not from any abrasion or anything like that on my forearms. Went to my doctor, and he said that it's probably due to the age and taking 81 milligrams of aspirin daily. I've never had a heart event, so he said I could stop taking it. I realized afterwards that I had also recently up my vitamin E from 1,000 IUs to 5,000. Since then, I've stopped taking the aspirin and the vitamin E and also fish oil and CoQ10. I don't know if CoQ10 is a blood thinner, but I understand that the rest of them are. Unless you have a question, I'll take my answer on the air, please.
All right. Dave, this is bringing up some really good points. 81 milligrams of aspirin. I don't know if any of you saw this, but last week there was a published study and a lot of talk about this. The recommendation for the 81 milligram baby aspirin a day has been revoked. They have looked at the data, and for people over 65, you have already exhibited, Dave, you're getting bruising. The risk of bleeding for taking an aspirin a day is higher than the benefit in people that have not had any heart attack or stroke. Now, if you had a heart attack or stroke, it's probably still a good idea to take it. There are other medicines that also can work there. He had brought up some other good points, too. Fish oil can cause blood thinning and some increased bruising. Vitamin E, I have never used a dose over 1,000 units because I don't think we need that much. So I would definitely not do 5,000. 400 to 1,000 is fine for me. The other thing I think about when people have bruising that shows up is how much vitamin C are they getting? One of the first signs of scurvy or vitamin C deficiency is bruising. You get bleeding gums, you get bruising in places you don't normally without having much of an impact. And so I would say look at your vitamin C intake, eat that rainbow of fruits and vegetables, and if you need to, take an extra vitamin C in this cold and flu season. But yes, stop the aspirin. We don't need it any longer. It seemed to have been a good thing, but it seems to be more risk for master citizens these days.
And I think I'm taking about 500 milligrams of vitamin C, but
that's
I can easily up
that's
that.
500 is definitely enough to prevent scurvy. So you're already there. So it's probably the fact that you're taking the aspirin and lots of supplements that help with thinning the blood. And CoQ10, I've not seen thin the blood. So you could probably resume that too. Just drop the dose of that vitamin E, stay off the aspirin. I bet you'll see no bruising.
As they're healing, sometimes the skin breaks, and if I do get an abrasion, it bleeds pretty easily. I'm just putting antibiotic on it and covering it.
Good idea.
That happens.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Harvey.
You're so welcome, Dave.
Pardon me?
You're very welcome, Dave. Have a great week.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, we've got no one here but you and me, so I'm going to remind everyone that you're listening to Health and Nutrition on WMNF Tampa, and you can call on in at 813-239-9663. Send your emails to dj@wmnf.org. And as we mentioned earlier, you can always hit the tip jar at WMNF.org as well. So what have you got for us in emails there, Doc?
Here's one from Jim asking about post-shingles neuropathy. Jim's wife is suffering from this, and her doctor recommended Cymbalta. She had a terrible reaction and couldn't function for about 6 days. Have I heard of this happening previously? Yes. Cymbalta is a serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor type of medication in what's called the antidepressant class. This is not unusual. Many people have adverse consequences with taking Cymbalta, and so there are other possibilities for treating post-herpetic neuralgia. One of them is to go on high-dose fish oil, 4,000 milligrams of EPA and DHA a day, not four capsules of 1,000 milligrams of fish oil that only have 200 milligrams of EPA and DHA, but 4,000 milligrams of EPA, DHA, so get the strongest pills or the a nice liquid to take a tablespoon of. That will take about a month to really penetrate the system. Alpha-lipoic acid is a great anti-neuropathic pain. I use a time-release alpha-lipoic acid of 600 milligrams called ALA-Max, and doing that 2 to 3 times a day will make an impact. B vitamins also are very potent. The methylated B specifically, you want methylcobalamin, which is methyl B12, at least 2,000 micrograms a day. Folic acid in the form of methyl tetrahydrofolate, that 2,000 micrograms a day. And benfotiamine, that's an activated thiamine, 200 milligrams a day. And an activated B6, pyridoxal 5-phosphate, probably about 10 to 20 milligrams a day. All of these will make an impact on the neuropathy pain. If that doesn't, and we want to get rid of the pain sooner, we could actually add in some GABA, pharma-GABA, which works on the GABA receptor and decreases pain sensation, pain perception. 250 milligrams of that 3 times a day is tolerated by most people. If your normal, natural neurotransmitter that your body makes, more of it can help to calm the system. And also, acupuncture can be very effective when you surround the area of neuropathy with some acupuncture points. You can dull that pain nicely. All of these things can be useful. In addition, I have had experience with class 4 laser, the hot laser that many acupuncturists and chiropractors are using these days. It has reduced pain in several of my patients rapidly. So we have lots of options out there that don't include toxic pharma that will get things moving and help you feel better.
Okay, a little pause there. Let's go to Jim from Gulf City.
Good morning, Jim.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Harvey. I was wondering about functional mushrooms. I don't know if you've addressed it yet, but, you know, things like reiki, turkey tail, and all that. They're good?
Yes, actually, I try to incorporate mushrooms into my diet on a regular basis. I made some chicken bone broth on the weekend and turned it into a vegetable soup. And one of the vegetables that I put in, I don't know if you can actually call it a vegetable, it's fungus, some sliced shiitake mushrooms. I like shiitake. They kind of remind me of little pieces of meat in the soup. But reishi is very good. Mayataki, also known as hen of the woods. One of my favorite things to do with hen of the woods, you know, you have to Google hen of the woods. It's a beautiful mushroom. It's like it's got feathers. And you break off chunks of it into bite-sized pieces, toss that with a little bit of olive oil, ground garlic or crushed garlic and some rosemary, salt and pepper, and put that in the broiler or the air fryer, and you've got these beautiful little chunks of mushrooms that remind me of eating steak points. They're so delicious and so good for health. Yeah, Mayataki has what I was talking earlier, I believe, with whoever called after Beverly, I believe, the woman who talked about the beta-glucan. Mayataki mushroom is very high in beta-1,6-glucan, so it's a really good immune stimulus, and it lifts up your natural killer cells, which kill viruses and cancers. Lion's mane, really good brain health. You can slice lion's mane and do a really light saute with it. You don't want to cook it long. You just want to get it warmed up, and that's really great brain food. Fungus is one of the best things that we can possibly ingest. They're here helping us grow and get better.
Oh, well, that's great, because I just ordered about $90 worth of mushroom, powders, turkey tail and a bunch of other ones. So so I didn't waste my money.
No, you did not. In fact, though, I would look for some fresh mushrooms and really enjoy that. find different ways to cook it and include it in your diet all the time. Throw some in your soup. Throw it in pasta. White mushrooms in pasta. It's a classic. White mushrooms on your pizza.
Oh, yeah. Ooh, yeah.
Yeah. You can do all kinds all right. of things with food. You don't need to take all kinds of stuff with it.
All right. Hey, thank you.
You're so welcome.
And have a great day, unless you have other plans.
Well, have a great day anyway.
Have a great day anyway, yes.
You too. Okay, take it easy. Thanks for your help.
Thanks, Jim.
You're welcome.
Well, we've got Fred from Sarasota waiting here, but I'm going to give the number on out one more time. If you want to join in on the conversation, it's 813-239-9663. And Fred's got a concern about long-term coming off of the long-term pain medicines. Hey there, Fred.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi, Doc. Yeah, I've heard that coming off of pain medications can be quite rough. And I heard kratom is a good supplement to take to help fight that. And I just heard you mention something about GABA also being a pain blocker.
Yes.
Can you recommend, what a person might take to help get through that?
Absolutely. One of the best things. Let me address kratom first. Kratom, not well studied, appears to have a lot of addictive potential. And so I don't recommend kratom for anybody because I've watched some 20-something men have real difficulty with addiction to kratom. So actually, what we found with the advent of medical cannabis is that in the states that originally did it, Colorado had some great statistics, they dropped opiate addiction by something like 30% after 2 years of medical cannabis. Cannabis really helps with pain. It helps to smooth your transition away from opiates. And I think it's a really good choice to go to a medical cannabis doctor and get certified so you can make that transition. In the meantime, other pain assistance, GABA can help, definitely. There's an amino acid called D-L-phenylalanine. Taking 500 milligrams of that a day, maybe two a day, actually dulls your perception of pain, but that only lasts for maybe the first month that you're doing it. So it's helpful in the transition. Also, some tyrosine, amino acid, helps to lift dopamine, which makes you crave less, and tryptophan, which supports serotonin, also helps you crave less. You can actually use those kind of amino acids and things to really help support the system so you don't feel the pressure to go back to it.
Okay, great. All right, I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Give it a try.
I will. Thank you very much. You have a good day.
You too.
Bye.
All righty there. Let's go on to some more emails here.
All right. Hi, Dr. Fred. This is from David. I visited China about 20 years ago and was surprised to see so many people wearing masks there. I am very disappointed that masking here in the U.S. is a political issue. Why has it become that, when it's a public health issue? This garbage about personal freedoms is really just a bunch of BS, he says. We could talk about that one for a long time because I believe in personal freedom. It's my body. It's my choice. And so I think that making a choice to wear a mask is really non-invasive, and I don't see why everybody doesn't choose to wear a mask when they are harmless and helpful at the same time. So I just don't understand why it is that we're having such difficulties with this issue. But yes, masking works. Even prior to COVID, you would notice that all throughout Asia, people wore masks because they know that actually it's courteous and that it actually helps reduce illness. He also asked me if I could comment about why so many black people seem to be hesitant to get the COVID vaccine. There's several good reasons. for many years, probably about 400, black people have been abused by governments in the West. Another reason is that in the 20th century, black people were experimented upon by the United States government using medical experimentation, kind of like Dr. Mengele over in Germany. And so there's a lot of hesitance I can understand about believing what the man is offering. And so, yeah, there is that. A lot more have come around, from what I understand, with the advertising campaigns that have been going on this past year to get people to take shots in arms. And so the reasons are multitude, but there are a lot of white people, and in fact, as a percentage of the whole, I think a lot more white people have chosen not to. I'd like to see those stats, but there's a significant portion of America that still has yet to do it. I think it's 50 million of us do not have shots in arms. And but despite that, it seems that the shots in arms are a debate worldwide. We see that in Israel with 85% or so inoculated, huge amounts of the infected actually have shots in arms. I just read another article about Singapore. We're having their largest surges in new cases ever, beating last summer, and that's with 85% of the population inoculated. Which is, hearing these statistics are, again, why a lot of other people are hesitant to get shots. Do we have anybody on the line?
And very timely that you ask. Yes, we've got someone asking about their, well, concerned about their mother who has spots on her arm when she gets easily bruised.
Hey, hello? Good morning, Dr. Harvey.
Good morning.
Hi, I just was curious if you have any sort of homeopathic approach to treating, I guess they're just bruises that she gets very easily when she hits herself. And they're like those reddish, purplish spots. And it's typically on her hands and arms. But she is on a blood thinner due to blood clotting history. But is there anything that she could do to try and alleviate those from happening?
Yeah, as I was mentioning previously, that vitamin C is very important there. And possibly limiting excessive doses of vitamin E and fish oil. But the elderly skin does get a little friable and sensitive. So taking right. something like orthosilicic acid, Biosil or Regenimax are two that I know of on the market. That helps to build up collagen in the skin. That with vitamin C may actually really help to improve the bruising. But since she's on a blood thinner, you're going to be dealing with bruising all along.
Right. I know they've recently reduced her dosage due to a better scan as of late. But as far as the vitamin C, would you recommend the same thing, the 1,000 per day?
Vitamin C, 1,000 a day is actually pretty good for somebody who's not had any kidney problems or kidney stones. Yeah, I think that's quite reasonable.
Okay. And then if you have time for one more question.
What you got?
I just wanted to see if you had any idea. As of late, I have had blood work done, and everything comes back good. My cholesterol is a little elevated, but just slightly at 220, and it's sort of offset by a good HDL. Other than that, I had an inflammatory marker that was just out of the normal range at 3.1. But so everything looks good blood work-wise, but when I go to bed at night, I start to... like I'll get heavy arms and my thoracic area starts to ache, like it gets very tight. And, yeah, I don't know. Is there any sort of autoimmune that could point to that or anything you can think of? Because I haven't slept in like a week. And when I'm awake during the day, it seems to get better. Like I don't seem to have issues during the day. But as soon as I go to sleep at night, I'll wake up like... within 30 minutes or an hour with heaviness and tightness throughout my body,
You might have sleep apnea or something like that. I would get a consult with your primary care doctor or a functional medicine doctor and find out what that is. That's pretty vague.
Yeah, no, I know. And I've been going, and so far, no luck. We've done so many blood tests. I don't know. I don't think it's sleep.
Well, it doesn't sound like you need a blood test for that. It sounds like a physical examination would be really useful.
Yeah,
have you had a good physical exam?
I would hate to say this, but no, I don't feel that I have.
Yeah, I understand that. I hear it all the time.
Yeah.
So go get a good physical exam from a doctor who wants to actually find out what's going on there.
Well, yeah, I hope so. Well, I appreciate it, Dr. Harvey. I enjoy the show every Monday. I missed you last week.
I'll be back next week.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you, too.
Bye-bye.
Well, Dr. Fred, we're down to about the last 4 minutes or so here, so I've got no callers. Let's, at this point, focus on the emails.
I will do that. Logan asks, what can be done about essential tremors? Several things. One, you want to take your stimulants away. Get rid of caffeine. Get rid of other kind of stimulants you're using. Try some magnesium. Magnesium is a great way to calm the nerve. Magnesium threonate, threonate, is a really good brain focused magnesium. And there's also a surgery that can be done called HIFU and also one called CyberKnife. They can actually eliminate, and I've seen it happen in one of my patients, completely resolve that problem. Dr. Harvey, what type of appointment would I make if I'm interested in seeing a functional medicine doctor while keeping my traditional doctor? I would say get a functional medicine consultation so you can have basically a tune-up visit. Talk about all the issues that are bothering you and get a list of things to do. Most functional medicine doctors like to do those kinds of consults to give people basically the tune-up visit. Here's another one from Charlie and Joe. A recent lab test showed glucose level was 161. Primary doctor prescribed 500 milligrams of metformin twice daily. When I take metformin, I feel toxic and lethargic. Would bitter melon be an effective substitute for metformin? Actually, I would back it up a little bit and do what's really been shown to be highly effective, because the glucose level of 161 is high, but it's not worrisome. I would go on time-restricted eating, meaning that you eat only between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. or 8 a.m. and 4 p.m. You have an 8-hour window to eat. Outside of that window, you get water and non-nutritive beverages like tea, herbal tea, or stevia-sweetened beverages. No calories outside of the 8 to 10-hour window. If you happen to eat 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., that's okay, but nothing after 6 p.m. because this regimen has been shown to reverse type 2 diabetes as long as you add a 30-minute walk every day to your regimen. Those two things turn back type 2 diabetes and you don't need medication. Beverly learned in Ayurveda school years ago about the relevance of facial wrinkles. She's 63 years old, does not have wrinkles, but getting one that is horizontal between the eyes. She read that this wrinkle has indications of cervical problems. I call it stress. When you're narrowing your brow and you're focusing really closely with your eyes, you tend to get a vertical line between your eyes. And that could mean even adrenal stress.
Well, they're back.
Last one, I think, was AFib last year. Successful cardioversion in March. Have taken Sotalol and aspirin since then. When can I discontinue aspirin while in sinus rhythm? I would actually stay on aspirin until I get checked for sleep apnea, because sleep apnea is one of the principal causes of atrial fibrillation. Fix that before you stop any other medication.
All right, well, we're getting to the end of this show. You got anything you want to give us as a teaser for next week's show?
Yes, next week we're going to be doing the fundraiser, and I'm going to talk about community and belonging, because we need to build this WMNF community, and I want to build my health and nutrition community. I have a lot of exciting information about community and belonging, and then we'll be planning the rest of the year, and I plan some changes for this show for coming up in the new year. And I'm really excited about that. So, see you next week.
All right, looking forward to it.
Donate this week if you could.
Yes, and stay tuned for 5 minutes of NPR News. And coming on up is Sustainable Living with Tanya Vidovic and Kenny Coogan. Their guest today will be Sandy Moore with Project Piaba. And I'd like to take this moment to thank Clark. Everybody on out there, have a great day. See you next week.
Thank you, Bill.